Acts chapter 10, let's go back with verses 5 and 6. And as I said, some of this material that we talked about last week and that generated some questions is going to get covered again because of what happens to Peter. But before we get to Peter, we have to spend a little more time with Cornelius. Acts 10:5 says, "And now send two men to Joppa and fetch one Simon, who is surnamed Peter, who lodgeth with one Simon the tanner, whose house is by the seaside." Now, you have here something that's very interesting as far as who Cornelius is told to go get. Who does he say you need to have come to your house? Simon Peter. And Peter's about 30 miles away. That's odd from one perspective. Let's go back to Acts chapter 8 for a second. Acts chapter 8 and verse 40. We've left off with this fella some time ago, but now let's go back and temporarily visit with him again. The last verse in Acts 8, what do we find about Philip? He went to Caesarea. Guess where Cornelius is? Caesarea. There's no indication that Philip left Caesarea. In fact, later in the book of Acts, it sounds like he's still at Caesarea. He and his family have decided to stay there. So you already have, from what we can tell, Acts 8 and verse 40, there is a Christian in the same town as Cornelius who needs some teaching. And not only is this guy a Christian, what kind of preacher would you say that he is? Acts 8. I mean, he's very effective. He's already taught the Samaritans. He's done a great work among the Samaritans. He has, through the laying on of the apostles' hands, he has some spiritual gifts, some supernatural abilities. So why not, with this angel that shows up and talks to Cornelius, why not just say, hey, there's a fellow in town, maybe just a few streets over from where you are. Call him over and have him teach you the gospel rather than go down and bug Peter and have him make that 30-mile trip one way. Why specify Peter over somebody like Philip? Oh, Carol, I saw you first.
Peter was an apostle. He could, Cornelius got the Holy Spirit before Peter did anything, but he's an apostle.
Okay, so if you're going to reach out to the Gentiles, it would probably make sense from God's perspective to use your biggest trump card. And in this case, it's going to be an apostle. So you could look at it from that point of view. Stan?
Well, Cornelius is a person who's in position of authority, used to having people underneath him. That indicates to me that he's got some age to himself. Philip was a relatively young man, but I could understand that Cornelius would be a whole lot more inclined to listen to someone who was older than him, plus someone who had that position of apostleship, rather than listening to someone who was Philip's age.
Okay, I think both of those are great answers. Anybody want to add to it? Let's back up a little bit in our minds. Matthew 16, Jesus said in verse 18 of Matthew 16, I'm going to build my church. The gates of Hades shall not prevail against it. And Peter, I'm going to give you what? I'm going to give you the keys of the kingdom. Now that same promise, people often associate that with Peter, and that's true, but that same promise was made to all the apostles in Matthew 18, 18. So this is not something that was just given to Peter, but all the apostles had the keys, but the focus in Matthew 16 is on Peter. Now let's think about those keys that Peter used. He used them on at least three occasions in the book of Acts. Occasion number one would have been what? Acts chapter 2, where we have the day of Pentecost, Peter is the featured speaker. And then, do you remember Acts chapter 8 and verse 18? We went back there for Acts chapter 8 and verse 40, but let's go halfway through the chapter. Now, when Simon saw that through the laying on of whose hands? The apostles' hands, the Holy Spirit was given. So the word apostle there is plural, the apostles' hands. Who were the apostles in Acts 8 that laid their hands on the Samaritans? Peter and John. So did John have the keys as well to the kingdom? He did. And John helped use the keys. But the other person who was involved with that was Peter. So Acts chapter 2, he's used a key. Acts chapter 8 and verse 18, he's used a key. And now God says what? The time has come for the Gentiles to hear the gospel. I could have had Philip go there. I'm sure he would have done a perfectly good job. But who am I going to use? Peter, you. You're going to have to come, and you're going to once again use the key. So the answers that Carol, the answers that Stan gave were excellent answers. But once again, I think you have to go back and tie this into Matthew chapter 16, verse 18. The King James translation, if you have it, in Acts chapter 10, it has some additional information in verse 6 due to a manuscript variation. Those additional words say, "He shall tell thee what thou oughtest to do." Now, I only mention that primarily for one reason. If you're curious about it, that's fine. But the other thing that word translated oughtest is that word dei, D-E-I. And that's that little word. Remember, my illustration for that is a triangle. If you have a triangle, it must have how many sides?
Three.
So if this were part of the original thought, he's saying Peter's going to come, and he's going to tell you some things that not that you just ought to do, that's good to do, but he's going to tell you some things which you must do. These are things which are absolutely required. You have lived a good life, and you're giving the alms, and you're praying, and you're doing all these wonderful things. But you are not in a right relationship with God. There are some things, if that manuscript variation is right, that you are absolutely required to do in the sight of God. We have, in addition to that, the information in Acts 10:22, and also the information in Acts chapter 11 and verse 14. These two additional references tell us beyond any doubt there were some things that Cornelius needed to do. In Acts 10:22 it says, "And they said, Cornelius, a righteous man, and one that feareth God, and well reported of by all the nations of the Jews, was warned of God by a holy angel to send for thee into his house and to hear words from thee." So he had to hear words. And then as you look at Acts 11 and verse 14, it's even stronger there. "Who shall speak unto thee words whereby thou shalt be saved, thou and all thy house." So there were some things, there were some words, some information that he needed to hear. Now here's an important word to study for just a bit. As you go back and you look at those two references, Acts 10:22 and Acts 11:14, he says the salvation was going to come by what means? Yes, you're going to hear these words and you're going to be saved. You remember the class that we had on figurative language a few weeks ago? That's important because of what we have here. How is the salvation, the angel says, going to occur? You're going to hear the words. Well, if you looked at that literally, what would that mean? All you have to do to be saved is hear the words. Now, if that's true, what should we do? If salvation comes just by hearing the words, what should we do?
Just hear the words.
Well, we should put the words out. I mean, put them on billboards or put it on radio and TV, because that's all people have to do. So when somebody comes along and talks about salvation, and they want to talk about salvation by faith alone, if you really want to cause their head to spin, turn over here to Acts 10, verse 22, and Acts 11 and verse 14, and say, well, what does the Bible say? All you have to do is hear the words, and you're going to be saved. Well, now, more is involved with that, really? This is all the text says, just hear the words. What point would we make? Remember the metonymy? You're saying one thing, but you means something else. And that's what we have here. You hear the words, but that is a metonymy for saying these are words that you need to obey. There's some things that God is going to require you to do. Final point before we look at Acts 10, 7 and 8. Would you say that the angel's instructions were specific? Clear. Send for this guy, Peter, Simon. He's located in this place. He's going to be staying with this person. He's going to be staying in a house which is by the seaside. And that illustrates for us how that when God has communicated with man, especially when it comes to the New Testament, we have very clear instructions. When it comes to salvation, when it comes to information on how to worship, when it comes to information on how to live the Christian life, God has laid that information out for us. It's understandable. Now, sometimes a person will say, I wish it said, you know, A, B, C, and it may not necessarily be structured quite like that, where we can go to World Book or Britannica and find things alphabetically ordered, but it's in there, and if we will do the needed studying, we'll be able to find that and figure out what God wants us to do in all ways. Anything that you want to add or ask before we look at Acts 10, 7 and 8?
Right, I just thought, with the angel giving those specific instructions, now the angel could have told him what to do to be saved.
Yes.
And then I could go a lot of different places with this, but I think the example is that we need to look, teach the Word. That's how you teach salvation, is through the Word.
Yeah, and God has put that Word in our hands. He certainly has plenty of angels that could go out and be dispatching the message here, there, and everywhere. but he said, it's my word that needs to be communicated. I've given that to human beings, and they're the ones who need to be the vehicle to take that out. But you're right, that point could be expanded in a lot of different ways, but those are a couple of really important points. Anybody else before we look at 7 and 8 and Acts 10? All right. Verse 7 says, and when the angel that spake unto him was departed, he called two of his household servants and a devout soldier of them that waited on him continually. And having rehearsed all things unto them, he sent them to Joppa. Cornelius was not a man to wait, at least on this occasion. He has received the information from the angel, and Luke tells us that he sprang into action. He calls how many people? There were two household servants, and then there was one soldier who was referred to as devout. The household servants, as you look at the word which describes those people, one source said that the word was more closely associated with the family than ordinary slaves. So these were people, maybe this isn't the best illustration, but we can put it in terms of dogs. There are dogs which, I mean, you think that's an outside dog, that's a mutt. I don't really want to have a lot of contact with that animal. But then you have some other dogs where people say, that's my lap dog, that's my inside dog. I treat the dog like a member of the family. If you can bear that image in mind, you have a similar approach being used with people who were slaves in the first century. There were some that just looked at a slave as a hired hand, work out there in the field or do whatever we want you to do. But then there were some other people who were slaves, and they were household slaves. They were seen as really like people, like an extension of the family. And that's what we have here. You also have this fella who is a soldier. He is referred to as a devout man. He was a religious man. That word is also applied to Cornelius back in verse 2. And Luke said that he continually waited on Cornelius. He was there to serve Cornelius in various ways. What I draw from that is that he picks three men. He probably could have picked from more, but he picks three men that he counts as absolutely reliable people that he, because this mission is so important, people that he thinks he can depend on, and says, okay, I'm putting this in the hands of you three. This is a very important task. One thing that caught my attention, the soldier continually waited on him. That word is also associated with prayer. Paul joined that word with prayer at least twice. Once will be in the book of Colossians chapter 4 and verse 2, and then over there in the book of Romans chapter 12 and verse 12. We've also seen that word earlier in the book of Acts. Remember back there in Acts chapter 2 and verse 42, what is said in conjunction with the apostles' doctrine, and they continued, how in the apostles' doctrine they continued? Steadfastly. Well, that word rendered steadfastly in Acts 2:42 is the same word which is translated continually and applied to the devout soldier in Acts chapter 10 and verse 7. So you can see how that word is used in some other parts of the New Testament. Cornelius gets his three guys together, and then what does he tell them? He rehearses all things. He says, this is what happened. This is what you guys are being asked to do, and gives them information about their destination and so forth. He says, you need to go to Joppa. That would have been about 30 miles away from where he was. Travel time in that day and time would have been about 10 hours. So we don't know if they walked or if they went by maybe horseback or something else. Carol?
Would it be safe to assume that these two household servants and the soldier would be part of the people in his household that became saved?
I think that is a very logical conclusion, because later we're going to read that Cornelius calls his friends together. And when you have these household servants, they were seen as members of the family, that they surely were included in that Bible study as well. And who knows what Peter may have said to them on the way back. 30 miles, I mean, Peter's only coming 30 miles that first time to go ahead and get to the house. But he could have had some questions for them and likely done some preliminary teaching. So gave him plenty of time to lay some groundwork there. When you look, we'll look at the word which is used to describe what Cornelius told the people that he was sending out, the word is tied in with our English word exegesis. Now that's a big word, but exegesis means if you're going to exegete a biblical text, you're going to dig into it to try to figure out what it means, try to explain it. And that's what he did for these people. You have the same word being used in some other places. Remember John chapter 1 and verse 18, Jesus declares unto us what the Father's like. He is trying to explain to us what the Father is like. Cornelius was trying to explain everything to these people. That tells us a little bit about something when it comes to this fellow. There are some people, think about Nicodemus. Remember when he came to Jesus, what time of day did he come? Night. Now, we're not specifically told why he came at night. He could have been working long hours or who knows what. Maybe one of the kids all tucked in. But why come at night possibly? Nobody else is going to know. I'm going to have an interest in God and spiritual things, but I just kind of... Remember the Shank book that we looked at? You know, they're kind of reading it separately. One really doesn't want to share the information with the other. And people sometimes do that with spiritual things. Was that, though, how Cornelius acted? No. I mean, he's up front. He simply says, look, I have some interest in spiritual matters. This opportunity has been afforded us, and we're going to take advantage of it, and I want you three to go back and get Peter. So they reach Joppa the next day about noon. We know that from Acts chapter 10, verse 9, Acts chapter 10, and verse 17 as well. Anything that you want to add or ask before we move on to Acts chapter 10, verse 9? Okay. In that ninth verse, it says, now on the morrow, as they were on their journey, they drew nigh into the city. Peter went up on the housetop to pray about the sixth hour. We don't know anything about the transportation arrangements that were used. As I said, they may have ridden an animal. Maybe they walked. Who knows? You'd think if they took an animal or animals that Peter probably would have had something to ride back as well, but that's not necessarily stated. One source offered this information as far as how to look at the text, and I think it's probably correct. He says the best reconstruction seems to be this. The servants of Cornelius left Caesarea the morning after his vision. They traveled 20 miles and stopped for the night. The next day they covered the remaining 10 miles, arriving at Joppa about noon. After staying there overnight, they started their return trip the next morning, the third day after the vision. Stopping the fourth night, they would travel the last 10 miles or so on the fourth day. And that ties in very well with what Peter is told by Cornelius. And that's going to be in verse 30. 4 days ago, a man stood by me in bright clothing. So 4 days are involved. Exactly how you divide those up, Luke doesn't tell us. But that scenario as far as 2 days travel there, 2 days travel back, that certainly is an easy way to account for the 4 days. And, you know, 30 days certainly could have been a good trip. And he probably wanted to have a little compassion for Peter as well. So the angel said that Peter was in a house, and that creature was correct. Peter was staying at that house, and he was there when the delegation from Caesarea arrived. Once again, you have sometimes people, you're thinking, well, let's go over to their house, or we're hoping that they're home. We'd like to get some assistance from them. You show up, and they're not there. Somebody says they're out of town. When you think about Peter, that could have been true for him. He could have been out of town under other circumstances and maybe not available or sick or who knows what. But in this particular case, God's providence worked very, very well. Peter needed to be home. He was home, and the people were able to find him. Peter, the Bible says it was about the sixth hour. It was about noon. He was on the housetop. He went up there to pray. When you look at the Old Testament, you have some indications. One of those would be back in the book of Psalms, Psalm 55 and verse 17. That indicates that there were about 3 hours each day that the Jewish people had a habit of praying, and one of those times would have been the noon hour. The roofs in ancient Palestine, we've talked about this a little bit before because we've seen it in some other places, but in our area, we think oftentimes about a roof with an incline, and if you're going to get up on the roof, you probably want to be really careful. Maybe you'll need some scaffolding, some roof jacks, those kinds of things. But in Palestine, the roofs may have had a slight incline, or maybe they were flat. I think flat probably would have been the more popular thing. There's an interesting statement about this. I kind of think of it as God being the first one to come up with a building code. But back in the book of Deuteronomy, and I'm going to read this, Deuteronomy chapter 22 and verse 8. Because these people had these flat roofs and because these areas were usable space, they used them for a lot of different things, but still it is a roof. God said that they needed to have some kind of guardrail. God said, 22:8 Deuteronomy, when you build a new house, then thou shalt make a battlement for thy roof, that thou bring not blood upon thy house, and if any man fall from thence. So God said, I want you to have this rail, I want you to have this area intact. So just like today, you might be at an elevated area, and there's going to be that guardrail, there's going to be a barrier there to hopefully prevent people from going over the side and being injured or being killed. And God said, if you're going to build a house, I want you to put a guardrail up there. So Peter was in that kind of space. As you look at Scripture, you find that those areas were used for a lot of different things. You find that, for example, Joshua chapter 2 and verse 6, it was used sometimes to store grain. Another passage would be 2 Samuel chapter 11 and verse 2. You think about David, where was he walking when he sees Bathsheba? He's up there on the roof, so it would have been a place to rest and relax, but unfortunately David used it for a different purpose. Nehemiah chapter 8 and verse 16 talks about people after the deliverance from captivity using it there. Steve?
I don't know about back in those days, but there are some countries where the goats and the sheep
sure
graze on the roof. They grip grass.
Yeah.
You don't want them falling off the roof either.
No. No. In the Northeast, there's actually a restaurant, and it's not the only one, but you can see the goats on the roof. Anybody ever seen those restaurants? Well, Teresa was with me, so she raised her hand. But, yeah, you can actually see they've got goats on the roof is the only thing that sticks in my head right now, but they've actually got the green grass up there, and there's an entranceway, like a stairway, for the grass, the goats, to come up and munch on the nourishment that's up there. It's really something to see. But we had the chance to eat there and watch the goats for a little while run around on the roof. But you do find that kind of thing, not necessarily for a restaurant, but you're exactly right. You find that Jeremiah 48 and verse 38 was sometimes a place to go and publicly mourn the loss of a loved one. Acts 10:9, here we see that it's being used as sort of a place for a private devotional, a time to prayer, time to pray. You also find 1 Samuel 9:25, it could be used to conduct meetings. And then you also have this reference. Remember over there in Luke chapter 12 and verse 3, you may not remember the passage, but you may remember the sentiment. Jesus said, share it from the rooftops. Today, if you want to talk to your neighbors, where do you talk to your neighbor at?
Yard.
All right, yard, or maybe you're close to the street, probably not standing in the middle of the street, hopefully, but maybe the front porch or the back porch, wherever it's nice. But if you had this kind of roof, houses are close together, you can actually talk to your neighbor. And that's what Jesus means in Luke 12:3 when he says, shout it from the rooftop. You'd be able to share from the rooftop the information with your neighbor. So this was a space, very popular, very common, and it was used in a lot of different ways. Anything that you might add or ask before Acts 10, 10 to 12? Therese?
Well, the houses would have been close together.
Yes.
Because they had to fit in the wall.
Yeah. So, again, you could probably have reached quite a few people had you raised your voice a bit. Tim?
Still do that places like New York City. It's quite common there.
Yeah, I've never been there, but as far as some of the pictures that you see, I didn't mention that in class, but that was lingering in the back of my head. You have people up there doing things. Maybe they'll grow some kind of garden on the rooftop, or you'll see some other people out there running. So like I say, all I can reference there would be some of the pictures, but if somebody else has been there and can talk about the rooftops in New York, I don't know, Steve or Harper's maybe, okay. So what do they do up there? I mean, I'm assuming some bad stuff happens up there, but hopefully some good stuff too.
Okay.
Okay. So again, a place to relax and kind of get away from things, maybe a place to visit. So in some respects, maybe a little bit similar to what you have in Scripture. You sometimes think about people running from police from the rooftops. That's kind of what comes to my mind sometimes. They're jumping from one to two to three to four, but I assume some good things happen up there too.
I think that probably some of these people in this ancient times, being up on high roofs like that made them feel closer to God.
I'm sure it did. People, that's one of the reasons why people have sometimes ascended mountains, because they were thinking that that would, maybe not literally, but at least internally, give them that sense that they were trying to reach out in the best possible way to the Almighty. That it? Okay, let's look at Acts 10, 10 through 12. And the attention is now going to switch to Peter. He became hungry and desired to eat. But while they made ready, he fell into a trance. And he beholdeth the heaven open and a certain vessel descending, as it were a great sheet, let down by four corners upon the earth, wherein were all manner of four-footed beasts and creeping things of the earth and birds of the heaven. Now, it's possible to be involved with, I guess, anything, but in this case, a spiritual matter, and to be distracted. Sometimes it's possible to be distracted quite easily, and Peter is distracted. He's hungry, and he wants to eat. If you have the King James translation, and you were following along carefully, what's it say? He wasn't just hungry, he's very hungry. Now, again, I guess there can be some debate about how hungry somebody is, but he definitely had the desire to eat. In fact, the desire that he has to eat is expressed with the imperfect tense. So this isn't something that's just sort of a passing thought. I wish I could get food at some point. I'm really hungry. So maybe that's why the King James translations included the word very.
I'm not getting ahead of things here, but was he so hungry that he was hallucinating? I mean, if he hadn't eaten in a long, long time, maybe he was...
Are you tying that in with the trance?
Yeah.
Okay. I think that would be something that some people, if they were not looking at the Bible in a favorable way, they might try to argue, so that's a good point to bring up. But when you look at the account as far as its entirety, he he's still within his right mind. Yeah, but I do think that you would find some people who might suggest that. So good thought, Steve. Thank you. All right, Peter wants some food. Did God know he was hungry? You think God still today knows when his people are hungry or thirsty or whatever the needs are? He's still aware of those things. Was God able to use Peter's hunger to help promote the gospel? He was. Actually helps Peter in the process as well. So things which may seem regular or things which may seem insignificant to us can sometimes be used by God to fulfill his will. The other detail in verse 10 consists of needing to wait while food was being prepared. If you're really hungry, that's not always the most pleasant thing, but that was the boat that Peter was in. Now, the next chapter, Acts 11, is going to have some of the same information that we have in Acts 10, and some of that same information includes what we have here. But there are a few differences. If you look ahead a bit, Acts 11 and verse 4, Peter is explaining this, but the text says that he explained things in order. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that Acts 10 is out of order, but if you want a good sequence of events, remember that you want to combine Acts 10 with Acts chapter 11. And it's interesting to me that as Peter talks about things in Acts chapter 11, he doesn't mention his hunger. Luke mentions that for us in Acts chapter 10, but that's omitted in Acts 11. He also doesn't mention anything about his praying, but you do have in Acts 10 and Acts 11 a reference to the trance. A lot of people have been curious about that trance, and kind of goes back to what Steve was asking about a little earlier. What does this word rendered trance mean? It's explained a little bit if you look further in Acts 10. Let's take a look at Acts 10, 17. Now, while Peter was much perplexed in himself, what word is used there?
Vision.
The vision. So you don't have a good explanation for the word trance back here in the first part of the chapter, but if you move ahead a little bit, now this trance is called a vision. And we're more familiar with the word or with the idea of a vision. If you look down in verse 19, you have Peter's experience being described there once again. And what Peter thought on the vision, so it's called a vision a second time. Then, if you were to once again combine the accounts, Acts 10 and Acts chapter 11, you'd find this from Acts 11 and verse 5. I was in the city of Joppa praying, and in a trance, and while he's in the trance, he sees a vision. So this is a state that allows him to see this vision from God. Cornelius has received a vision, Acts 10:3. Now Peter is receiving this vision from God. Now here's where things are going to get interesting. And here's where we go back to some of the items that we're talking about last week. Peter's vision involved the opening of what? All right. Some translations might use the word plural. I'm assuming that yours does. Does it say heaven or heavens?
It says
singular. Okay. That's going to be in Acts 11. At least that's how it is in the ASV. He holdeth the heaven open. Now, here's to kind of go back, and if you were not in last week's class, we talked about especially some information from Revelation chapter 4 and verse 5 and a little discussion as far as heaven and what's going on there and whether or not people have actually seen what's taking place in heaven. I was trying to suggest, and I apparently did a very poor job of that, and I apologize for that, but I tried to suggest that when we look at Scripture, if we have some passages which talk about heaven being opened and people seeing what's taking place after the heaven is opened, what they were seeing is a heavenly vision, but that is not necessarily a good description of what is actually taking place in heaven. Now, Teresa kind of got back with me later and said, that sounds like double talk. I just don't think that that makes a lot of sense. Well, let me see if I can clean that up a little bit. Let's go back to last Sunday's lesson, sermon-wise. Do you remember how many heavens the Bible describes? I thought there were four. Oh, okay. So at least four. The first heaven would be what?
Sky,
where the birds fly. That would be Genesis chapter 1 and verse 20. The second heaven is what? Space, the heavens, 2 Peter chapter 3 and verse 10. The third heaven would be Hades or paradise, 2 Corinthians chapter 12. And then you have what we maybe think of as the fourth heaven, which is going to be God's dwelling place, where the eternal home for the saved. Now, as you think about passages like Acts 10 and verse 11, the heaven was opened, the fourth heaven is how I understand that. And somebody says, well, if this fourth heaven, if the eternal place for God and his people is opened up, and you have a description of what's taking place there, then that must tell us exactly what heaven is like. Problem number one with that, at least in my mind. What's coming down from this fourth heaven, if you will? Animals. Do you think there are literally animals in heaven? I don't think that is going to sit very well with anybody. So you have here then this difficulty. If you actually believe that you have heaven open and you're seeing what's there, then in this case you have to say that animals are there. But the problem becomes even a little more complicated when you start looking at some other passages which talk about the heaven being open. Let's take a look at the book of Revelation for a bit. Go back to some of the things that we alluded to last week, but we'll try to develop in a little more detail today. We'll start with Revelation chapter 1 and verse 10. The word vision is not used here, but John uses similar language. He says, I was in the Spirit on the Lord's day. So, again, he's having the same kind of thing happen to him. And then you have over in Revelation chapter 4, we'll start with verse 1. And these things I saw, and behold, he says, what happened? There was a door open where? In heaven. So he's got this vision. Heaven's involved. And he says, as he's seeing what's taking place, what opens in heaven? A door. Do you think that there are literal doors in heaven? I don't. I mean, nothing needs to be barricaded in heaven, and it's a spiritual place. But still, again, he's talking about what he sees in this heavenly realm, and he sees a door. Well, so we've got animals associated with heaven, Acts 10. And we've got a door associated with heaven in Revelation chapter 4 and verse 1. If you look down a little bit more, let's see what we've got in Revelation 4, 5. And out of the throne, again, this is the heavenly vision, proceeded lightnings and voices and thunders, and there were seven lamps of fire burning before the throne, which are the seven spirits of God. I also have a difficult time believing that there were seven, that there are seven literal lamps burning before the throne of God. Now, again, maybe I'm just completely way off on that, but that seems to me to be really odd. In the next chapter that we talked about, let's take a look at Revelation chapter 5 and verse 6. This is a description of Jesus. And I saw in the midst of the throne and of the four living creatures and in the midst of the elders a lamb standing. Who do you think the lamb is? Jesus. As though it had been slain. How many horns does it have? Seven. And how many eyes? Seven. Now, can you imagine that picture? You've got a lamb, which has the appearance, it looks like it's been slain or killed. And it's got seven horns, and it's got seven eyes, and that's Jesus. If we could go to heaven, I have a difficult time believing that if you could see Jesus, he looks like a dead lamb with seven horns and seven eyes. But as John has this heavenly vision, that's exactly what he says he saw. And then you have, if this isn't enough, in that same chapter, Revelation chapter 5, let's look at verse 8. And when he had taken the book, the four living creatures and the 24 elders fell down before the Lamb, having each one of them, what, a harp. So again, John sees harps. So you ask the question, you know, he's seeing this, it's the heavenly vision, is this really what's taking place in heaven? And then, let's take a look at two more places, Revelation chapter 6. Let's see what we've got in verse 2. And I saw, and behold, what's he see now? He sees a white horse. And he that sat upon the horse had a bow. And there was given unto him a crown, and he came forth conquering and to conquer. Who do you think the person on the white horse is? Well, that's probably the Lord. So would we say that John, as he has this vision of heaven, he's seeing Jesus on a white horse with a bow, and he's out there conquering. And then one more. Again, I guess you can beat the point to death, but one more, Revelation chapter 19. Two verses from this chapter. We'll start with verse 11 and then also see what we have in verse 14. Notice again verse 11. And I saw the heaven opened. That's important. So he's getting this picture of heaven. And behold, he sees what? There's another white horse. And he that sat thereon is called faithful and true, and in righteousness he doth judge and make war. And then if you move down to verse 14, same chapter, he says, and the armies which are in heaven followed him what? On white horses. So John says, heaven opened, and this is what I saw, a bunch of horses. There's Jesus, he's riding his white horse, and you have all these other people, they're all riding white horses. So that brings me back to the question, if you understand heaven being opened, and what the writer saw when heaven was opened is an accurate depiction of what heaven is like, then we've got birds and other creatures in heaven, and we've got people riding horses in heaven, and we've got Jesus, you know, slinging a bow, and all kinds of other things. And that just doesn't make sense. That's why I was trying to communicate last week that when you have these pictures of heaven, quote unquote, you have, in my estimation, in my understanding, a picture of what God is doing, symbolically, rather than saying this is, if you were there, what you would actually see. And I know that does sound maybe a little bit like double talk, but I think that's a conclusion that you're forced to when you start looking at these passages.
Well, isn't a vision just something that you're told or see to convey an idea or something
yeah.
like that? Because, and then in John 1:51, Jesus told Nathanael, "Truly I say to you, you shall see the heavens open and the angels of God ascending."
Yeah, yeah. I didn't include that one as well, but again, do we believe that there's a literal ladder of it? And angels are literally running up and down ladders like we would do in life? No. But you do have that language used, but... Okay. As far as angels meeting... Okay. Well, I'm not denying that. I'm just saying that the idea that angels actually use a ladder.
Oh, every time?
Yeah.
Or a slide
board. I gotcha. I would think that would be a fairly long ladder. But you have those things, as Carol was indicating, that is a vision, and it's designed to say, I'm trying to tell you what God is doing behind the scenes, rather than we're pulling the curtain back, and this is actually what you would see if you're in heaven. Tim?
All these visions and things that we're reading about, they're talked about in terms of things that those people could understand.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean that they're literal things, but they're presented in this vision in a way that these people can understand what's being said, because without those images, it would be just way over our heads. We just wouldn't get it. We have enough trouble getting it as it is, you know, sometimes.
Somebody says, I was hit with a ton of bricks. Well, that could be literal. But if it were literal, you'd probably be dead. I wouldn't be talking to you. But somebody uses that graphic, figurative expression to say, things have really been bad. I've had all kinds of catastrophes in my life. And the book of Revelation uses figurative language to an extensive degree. And then you have, obviously, in Acts chapter 10, this information which was given to Peter in a vision as far as seeing these creatures to help him understand something that was symbolic. So Scripture, he's used that kind of imagery many, many times. Let's think. Anybody else want to jump in there quickly, Steve?
Well, it mentions four corners. Now, it could have been three corners, but it was four corners. Does the number four here have anything to do with... Represents man's world, correct?
Correct. I'm just going to pick that up from you. Great point, and that just leads us to where we've got the last couple minutes for. You have this sheet let down from heaven, and the King James translation words it slightly differently because of a manuscript variation. It sounds like it's actually descending almost on Peter. So, I mean, it's very, very close to him. It's something that he wouldn't have to have moved in this vision very far to access. And it's a giant sheet-like image. It almost sounds like it's a big tablecloth. All kinds of creatures are on the sheet. Quick question. Do you think the creatures were clean or unclean? Remember, the Jews had two types of animals in their religious system, clean and unclean. Do you think the sheep, clean and unclean, or just clean or just unclean?
Unclean.
I think it was a mixture. When it says all manner of beasts, I think the hint there is that all manners of beasts were there. And there's some symbolism here. Let's see if we can wrap it up quickly. Why four corners? What did Jesus say? Take the Great Commission where? All nations. What did Jesus say in Acts chapter 1 and verse 8? Judea, Samaria, Galilee, and where? Uttermost parts of the earth. Had that been done by this point? No. What needed to be done? Take it and spread it out. Four corners? North, south, east, west. And those foods? Clean and unclean. Jews and Gentiles, by mixing all those different animals together, God was saying, You no longer look at the Gentiles in what kind of way? As unclean. They are now going to be regarded as acceptable to God, and they need to be accepted by you. So it was a powerful image to say that everything needed to be seen as okay. The other thing that I want to mention there quickly is when you go back to Genesis chapter 9 and verse 3, I believe it is, God, remember there in the beginning, before Moses' law, he said all, basically, things on the earth are going to be food for you. So when things started out, God, when it came to those various animals, said they're okay. Moses' law comes along and says, not everything is okay. Why would God have done that? Starts out and says, everything is great. Moses' law comes along and starts to restrict foods. Why do that? Well, there was that, but also to make God's people a distinctive people. To say that you are the people of God, and one of the things that's going to distinguish you as the people of God would be your choice of food. You eat these things. Gentiles, those outside the fold, don't. But now by saying, everything is on the table, no pun intended, everybody is welcome in God's sight.